Autism is a childhood disorder for which currently there is no known etiology. This means that we cannot identify specifically what changes in the body cause autism. There are many theories about the etiology of alterations inherent in autism spectrum disorder, but because the range of cognitive and behavioral impairment varies from individual to individual, it is difficult to treat. Standard autism treatments include a plethora of pharmaceuticals that cause more harm and create additional impairment. We also don't know what long-term pharmaceutical use in the autism population looks like, as many children with autism are just now reaching young to middle adulthood. Research surrounding cannabinoids as medicine for autism are now proposing a potential brain imbalance as a leading theory that manifests as the symptoms and behaviors associated with autism. The science behind cannabinoids in the care of autism patients has even piqued the interest of the Department of Defense, who is finishing up their own study on cannabinoids in the treatment of autism. On today's episode of Cannabis Nurse Truths, we explore the promising potential of cannabis to address this concerning pediatric disorder. Welcome to Cannabis Nurse Truths, where we know you can handle the truth about cannabis as medicine.
Welcome to episode number 12 of Cannabis Nurse Truths. Lee Foster with you once again, joined by the great Dr. Denise Foster. Don't forget to visit us on our official website, CannabisNurseTruths.com. New episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, on our website, on Spotify, Google, iTunes, Spotify. Did I say Spotify twice in there?
You did say Spotify twice.
Well, it's really important, Dr. D.
Spotify is great.
Wherever you get your podcasts, that's where we are. And follow us on Twitter or X. We're at Canna Podcast, CannaPotcast. Episode number 12, we're talking about autism and how it links with cannabis.
Very interesting links here. As we develop the research on autism, we are starting to develop an understanding of how the pathophysiology within the brains work. And this is significantly important when you think in the realm of cannabinoid research. We know that cannabinoids and the endocannabinoid system in the body have the potential to not only work as antioxidants, meaning reducing inflammation, but they are also patented by the Department of Health and Human Services as a neuroprotectant. So the link here is very important because this vulnerable population of children is affected the most significantly in autism spectrum disorder diagnoses. We know that 1 in 59 children by the age of 8 has been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder condition. And this is based on the Centers for Disease Control data. And boys are 4 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed with the ASD problems. Over the last 3 decades, there has been a 3-fold increase on the number of children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder across the world. What is going on that there has been a 3-time prevalence rate increase, not just in the United States, but everywhere? What's happening? What are the correlations? Is this environmental? Is this genetic? Is this something that has occurred after the child is into the rapid development stages of either infancy or young adulthood? So the problem is that there are 2 core symptoms associated with any of the autism spectrum disorders. The first is that there's deficits in social communication and interactions. Individuals with autism usually have a hard time interacting with other individuals and their environment. Now we're talking school. We're talking sociability with friends and even parents and other relatives and teachers. And so the behavioral and cognitive link there prevents them from this ability to interact with other humans. What's going on there? Another problem is that they have restricted or repetitive movements. And this is something that is unpredictable. They might have drooling, or they might have repetitive motions that preclude them from or prevent them actually from being a participant in society. Most individuals who have ASD to the highest level of the disorder on the spectrum usually have to have one-on-one guidance, meaning someone has to be with them all hours of the day. They're not only a danger to themselves because they're unable to care for themselves, but in some extreme cases, they may be a danger to others because they act out without inhibiting their own emotions or their own behaviors.
How much of the increase in the number of people being diagnosed with autism is simply because we have a better understanding of what autism is and we're better at diagnosing it? Do you think that that's a big part of it, or do you think there actually is like a large increase in the amount of people that have it?
I do believe there's a large increase. That's a great question because, of course, as our diagnostics get better and our ability to investigate conditions associated with neurological or inflammatory behavior in the body, this could be a chicken and egg type of thing. But the literature does not suggest that back in the earlier centuries that we had these types of conditions. We did have what we would informally call the insane asylums, right? The mental health asylums, where people who were kind of off were deposited and left because of their disease states. But these weren't typically children. These were not children that were being dropped off in the mental institutions of prior ages, because these people were already mentally impaired at either a young age and then had reached adulthood. We're now finding children very young that are as early as the cognitive behaviors and the ability to develop, measure or gauge development occurs. We're now finding these children as young as 1 or 2 years old, which is why people visit their pediatricians to plot the child's development and growth on the standard care, the standards of care. So I don't think that we're seeing something that was apparent back in the days. If it was apparent, it was very, very latent. It was very minimal as far as a prevalence. So this now begs the question, are there environmental concerns related to this threefold increase in the autism rates around the world? Is this environmental? Is it genetic? That's something that we also need to consider. Is this something with genes? We do know that certain conditions in pregnancy can predispose an individual for a higher risk for autism behaviors in children that are born from these mothers. So there's a lot of investigation now being focused on the etiology, meaning what do we now think of? And this comes to us because we've been investigating the cannabinoids and the endocannabinoid system and how those interact for both the neuroinflammatory effects, meaning they reduce neuroinflammatory diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. But we're also now thinking that this has a neuroprotectant, meaning it's going to help repair and prevent autism from developing. So it's very interesting to see the pathophysiology links to cannabis.
Pathophysiology, what's going on in autism?
So pathophysiology is the study of diseases. This is a fascinating science, and it is never settled. So don't let anybody tell you that it ever is, because we continue to discover more incidences in the body that we were not even aware of. We've talked before about how no one knew about the endocannabinoid system until the 1980s. Well, hello, here we are in the mid-2020s, and we are still not understanding fully what the endocannabinoid system can do in the body, but we do know that it exists, and it's becoming more and more apparent that the endocannabinoid system can be used to manipulate diseases like autism. In autism, we have several theories that are coming to the forefront. The first is that there is an alteration in the immune system. We used to consider the immune system and the inflammatory system two separate systems. We now lump them together as one system. The alterations found in the immune system of those individuals with ASD have shown that there is an immune deficiency, there is an immune dysfunction that then sets up a inflammatory response. This is a link between the neurons of the brain and, of course, the central nervous system going out to the peripheral nervous system of the body. Then that inflammation creates neuroinflammation as the body responds by trying to repair that dysfunction. This cycle includes some of the most important brain areas and brain cells in the activation of inflammatory factors that call inflammation to occur throughout the entire nervous systems throughout the body. This includes the central nervous system, our brain, our spinal cord. It includes our peripheral nervous system from those brain and spinal cord areas out to your little pinky and your little pinky toe. And then we also forget that we have a third nervous system, the gut-brain axis. This is why in the presence of autism spectrum disorders, you may have some GI impairments as well, because all of these three neurological systems have been infected by the neuroinflammation caused by defects in the neurons and the inflammatory and immune system. Researchers have proposed that the alterations in the immune and inflammatory function that become cyclical, and the longer that this occurs, the more this turns into autoimmune activity, meaning that the body is now setting up a situation where it's attacking its own nervous disorders, its own nerve cells, and that continues to exacerbate the longer that the individual is experiencing this. So that's why we don't have good measures about what happens between a youthful autism disorder patient to a middle adulthood autism disorder patient. I should say that we don't have useful data about that, because what do we usually do? We throw drugs at them as soon as we identify that there's a problem.
Well, we do that for everything.
We do that for everything, because pharmaceuticals are good and cannabis is bad. We're changing that. This is where we're starting to make these amazing endocannabinoid system and autism links, because we have found that the endocannabinoid system plays a major role in maintaining homeostasis or balance in the body. And this includes in the most significant systems like the central nervous system, the peripheral, and the gut-brain axis nervous systems. These systems are very much affected when the endocannabinoid system can be stimulated appropriately. The endocannabinoid system regulates cell function and maintains homeostasis. The endocannabinoid system works on a balanced motor coordination and the brain reward system and stress response. In the hippocampal areas of the brain, the endocannabinoid system supports memory function. It also affects appetite and the modulation of pain. And of course, the United States Department of Health and Human Services owns the patent on cannabinoids for their ability to reduce inflammation as an antioxidant and to provide protection and restoration and repair of function in the neuroprotectant category. So the researchers are now looking at all of the different receptors in the endocannabinoid system that could be linked to either identifying a dysfunction in autism and a potential treatment for autism. Currently, standards of care in relation to autism treatment involve both behavioral intervention and pharmaceutical intervention. Behavioral intervention is how to kind of retrain the brain. Let's do something repetitively until it maybe sinks in like a habit. Behavioral intervention seems to work, but not as well, I think, as what we want it to do, because these children growing into middle to older young adulthood have still the same problems. And again, those that are on the higher end of the ASD spectrum are still required to have a one-to-one minder all the time because of these behaviors. So while behavioral intervention works somewhat, we know that the majority of these populations have pharmaceutical interventions. It's incredible the amount of children who are on drugs for this condition. According to the data, 11% of children aged 0 to 12 years have tried 4 or more medications. By the age of 12, these children have tried 4 or more medications, but it gets worse, because by the time these children become teens, 18% of teens aged 13 to 18 have tried 6 or more medications. Imagine taking 6 or more medications as a teenager for these autism spectrum behaviors and deficits, and the disruption that occurs not only in the family unit, because now all care is surrounding treating this individual, but also the impairments that are being manifested as the individual is now subjected to the side effects of these very powerful drugs. Common autism meds include antiepileptics and antipsychotics, hypnotics, sedatives, and antidepressants. All of these work in the central nervous system, targeting receptors that have the potential to also be targeted by the endocannabinoid system through the use of cannabinoids. When we think of the balance between risks versus benefits, all of these medications, especially the antiepileptics, the antipsychotics, the hypnotics, and sedatives, have the ability to create their own severe side effects, including death. The antipsychotics are known to create more problems with aggression and irritability and dangerous metabolic effects. These include metabolic syndrome, where your body becomes resistant to insulin. That's why many of those with autism spectrum disorder seem to have a weight gain problem. Their appetite increases, they develop a weight gain, their body is unable to process the glucose in the body, and therefore they become more predisposed to metabolic syndrome, leading to diabetes. So keeping the diet healthy in an autism individual is very important. Remember that gut-brain axis that we talked about. The brain is impaired in relation to telling the gut that it already has some deficits. So then you add on the antipsychotics that can cause not only problems with metabolic syndromes like weight gain, but now we're also worried that they can cause irritability and aggression. These all have their own effects on cognition and behavior. They will make somebody sleepy and groggy and fatigued. Don't want to get out of bed in the morning, don't want to do anything around the house, don't want to get dressed, et cetera, et cetera. We also know that they can create other external problems related to their brain, meaning that they can have incessant drooling. They can have vomiting episodes and tremors because of the effects on the central nervous system. We have a paucity, meaning that there are not a lot of research studies that have investigated the long-term use of psychotics on a pediatric population, because it has just been in current times that the medical community has accepted a standard of practice that includes antipsychotics for this population. Long-term use of any drug is going to cause long-term damage in the human body. And this is especially important when you consider that in an autism spectrum condition, there is already significant damage to the nervous system. And now it seems that we're making that worse, which is why many, many parents are looking for alternatives to provide not only benefits with their autism spectrum patients, with their autism spectrum children, but we also want to look at it on a holistic level. How do we prevent the harms associated with these types of medications? Why can't we begin to include cannabis as medicine for this population? In addition to using all these types of central nervous system altering medications, we're also worried about drug-drug interactions. And this becomes a significant problem when you consider that the more drugs that you enter into the equation, the more potential there are from harms associated with drug-drug interactions. So there's risks all around in providing pharmaceutical treatments to children with autism.
Cannabis Nurse Truths is brought to you by Hemp Haven Wellness. Let's face it, hemp is complex, coming in several different forms. You probably have many questions about the differences between cannabis and hemp, and why hemp can be used in numerous ways to treat well-being. At Hemp Haven, they have the knowledge and expertise to guide your selection of hemp-derived products to meet your wellness needs. Hemp Haven is owned and operated by America's cannabis nurse, Dr. Denise Foster. With Hemp Haven, fight insomnia, relieve headaches, relieve pain, improve your mood, promote relaxation, and more. Visit Hemp Haven in Chesapeake at 480 Kempsville Road, or visit them online at hemphavenwellness.com. That's hemphavenwellness.com. For the highest quality and safest products on the market, you want Hemp Haven Wellness. So what does cannabis have to do with autism?
Cannabis has a lot to do with autism. The stigma surrounding giving cannabis to children lingers through the professional bodies on down to the medical colleges. I read a statistic here that showed that 75% of med school deans reported their graduates are either slightly prepared or not at all prepared to answer their patients' questions about medical cannabis. Our clinicians lack the knowledge, even of the endocannabinoid system, let alone using cannabis in a horrible, horrible population known as children. But we, again, focus on the most impairing and controversial cannabinoid found in cannabis, which is THC. Two professional governing bodies have come out with position statements on cannabis in the pediatric population. The American Academy of Pediatrics position shows that they do not support the use of medical cannabis due to insufficient efficacy evidence and the high risk of harm. The American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry is even against the use of medical marijuana or even isolated cannabinoids for core symptoms or co-occurring emotional or behavioral problems in children and adolescents with autism spectrum disorder. And they also say that the families should be educated about the risks and discouraged from using marijuana and cannabinoids for autism spectrum disorder. So two governing bodies that guide pediatric practice have come out specifically against using these compounds without even knowing how they work. But they sure as hell can tell you, or maybe they can't, how the pharmaceuticals work and what the long-term effects are and the side effects and the risks versus benefits. No one is talking about this in relation to caring for one of our most vulnerable populations. And this is where the endocannabinoid research and the cannabinoid research is now steering, as we're finding actual evidence that indicates that children in the autism spectrum disorder conditions have alterations in their endocannabinoid system. What? This means that these children are born or during their developmental stage have conditions that have altered how their body maintains homeostasis, especially in the conditions that are associated with the neuroinflammation guiding the behaviors and cognitive changes in all central, peripheral, and gut-brain axis nervous system tissues. Researchers are astonished as they begin to identify differences in people with autism in versus the general population in relation to their endocannabinoid system. The first major difference that was found was that there are lower circulating endocannabinoid levels and changes in cannabinoid receptors and enzymes in autism spectrum disorder patient populations. This means that there are distinct differences in the system and compounds in our body that have one purpose, balancing our body's ability to maintain homeostasis. The endocannabinoid system is also extremely important for maintaining adequate social functioning. And this begins as early as in the uterus. As the baby is developing and in early gestational stages, the brain of the developing fetus is creating myelination and synaptic pruning and dendritic plasticity. These are all changes in the shape and functioning and connectivity of the brain spaces, the brain areas. And all of these, as they develop, support healthy neurotransmitter balances. This is an extremely significant identification on how the endocannabinoid system can affect dysfunctions in these brain regions related to the neuroinflammation and the immune disruption caused autism. One of the most important endocannabinoids in our body is called anandamide. We've talked in earlier podcasts about how anandamide is the brain circulating endocannabinoid, meaning it is our brain's pot molecule. When it interacts with the cannabinoid 1 receptor that are found in all cells in the brain, in the central nervous system, in the peripheral nervous system, and in the gut-brain axis, we're finding that the anandamide molecule that our body makes will create, for instance, in the brain, a runner's high feeling. It's our wonderful feeling of bliss, and it gives us these feelings of elation, just like the THC molecule does. But in the cannabinoid 1 receptor, anandamide inhibits the release of neurotransmitters. This is how our body balances both excitatory neurotransmitters like glutamate. Glutamate is a neurotransmitter that affects excitability in neurons. It helps that neuron transmit a smooth signal on down the line to your pinky toe. It also, now I'm back to talking about anandamide. Anandamide also causes the inhibition of the release of a neurotransmitter called GABA. GABA is a calming neurotransmitter. And what we see here are that these two neurotransmitters being inhibited by anandamide can either affect memory and learning, or calming and anxiety, or sleep. So when there is an imbalance in these electrical impulses that both excite or calm the neurotransmitter system going through the body, this is where we begin to find the imbalances that are related to autism behaviors and cognitive deficits. Overall, when you consider how the endocannabinoid system will balance the body's homeostasis, in autism spectrum disorder, we see what we frame as a reduced endocannabinoid tone. There are so many receptors that are actively working in the body's central, peripheral, and gut-brain axis nervous systems that we do not have enough endocannabinoids like anandamide to regulate and balance that excitatory and calming neurotransmitter release. Therefore, we're getting imbalances mainly in the glutamate system, the excitatory system. And it is this system that is responsible for many of the neurological deficits regarding autism spectrum disorders, such as seizures. Seizures are the most outward sign of this excitatory glutamate release. And that's why most of the pediatric population that does have ASD also has some form of epileptic disorder as well.
We have more to touch on when it comes to research, Dr. D.
Research is exploding in endocannabinoid land, and focusing on autism spectrum disorder is a very great way to identify how we can begin to use cannabinoids safely and appropriately, because we have evidence that in the endocannabinoid system, there are upregulations of the cannabinoid 1 receptors in the hippocampus in patients with autism. This means that there are too many receptors. These are cannabinoid 1 receptors in the hippocampus area of the brain in autism spectrum disorder patients. These are receptors that are not being met with anandamide. The body's own ability to regulate anandamide at the CB1 receptor means that they have difficulty controlling emotions. And emotions lead into cognitive behavior, because think about when you're angry, or when you're stressed, or when you're sleepy, or when you're frustrated. Can you think well? Do you react well? Do you react great? You know, do you react to great news, to bad news, right? Well, how do you affect your own cognition by just how you feel? In ASD, we also have found that there are lower circulating endocannabinoids, specifically those cannabinoids associated with emotional and pleasure balance, those that make you feel good, that make you feel uplifted and happy, and you're able to regulate your emotions based on your environment and your own internal beliefs. So alterations in the endocannabinoid system are going to drive more research. We have research going back as far as 2013. And this is where a group of researchers found that not only are the cannabinoid 1 receptors in the brain affected by this endocannabinoid system balance, but the cannabinoid 2 receptor as well has been imbalanced on the blood's mononuclear cells. These are cells, the mononuclear cells are actually part of the immune system. This is the connection between the inflammatory system and the immune system imbalances that are seen in autism spectrum disorders. When we think about how the immune system drives inflammation, even the immune cells are deficient because the cannabinoid 2 receptor is found on every single immune cell in the body. If we find that the cannabinoid 2 receptor is upregulated, meaning that there's an increased expression of more of these types of receptors on the peripheral blood mononuclear cells, this means that there's an immune inflammation connection going on that's also creating a situation that predisposes this population to deficits in immune health. An interesting study came out in 2015 that showed that oxytocin. We associate oxytocin again with a flood of feeling good. Oxytocin is one of the hormones in our bodies that just makes you feel good. We know that oxytocin increases, for instance, during pregnancy to help alleviate with childbirth pains and development pains. So we also know that through research, anandamide drives oxytocin signaling. So if you're not getting enough anandamide to meet the demands of your oxytocin receptors, you are now not giving that social reward balance that oxytocin is aware is related to. So two deficits, both at the cannabinoid 1 and the cannabinoid 2 receptors, both in the neurological system and in the immune system, then two compounds are being affected that our body should normally release and balance and regulate that are deficient in autism spectrum disorder. That would be anandamide, the cannabinoid just recently discovered in the 1980s, and oxytocin, one that we are already familiar with. These two hormones, neurotransmitters, are not being released in the presence of autism spectrum disorders. One of the most recent studies is coming out of Israel, where they are very progressive about their medical cannabis use for all populations. In fact, cannabis use is very appropriately seen as a medicine in Israel, and doctors throughout Israel are allowed to prescribe medical cannabis to any population that they believe would be benefited by its use. So in Israel, in 2018, they administered a ratioed concentration of exogenous cannabinoids, meaning cannabis compounds that they extracted from the plant, to supplement autism spectrum disorder populations. This was a 20 to 1 ratio, meaning that there were 20 parts of CBD to 1 part of THC. They did this for 4 months, and they did a variety of studies, and they did a variety of tests to see what would happen in relation to using this very broad ratio of 20 to 1. Over time, they found that there were 80% decreases in problematic behaviors. 62% of the child's behavior improved significantly. 50% improvement in the level of communication, and 40% their anxiety symptoms were significantly improved. The dosage that caused this was 160 milligrams of CBD to 8 milligrams of THC. And if you look at our parameters for safe administration of the impairing compound, that's THC, you will find that we strive to keep it in any population at 10 milligrams or under per day. So this study supported the fact that microdoses of THC, 8 milligrams a day, can be considered a microdose. 8 milligrams of THC per day combined with CBD at 160 milligrams a day provided significant experiences and improvements in all forms of ASD symptoms. Why are we not doing this? Why are our pediatric populations suffering? Why are our professional organizations like the Pediatric Psychological Associations and the American Academy of Pediatrics not investigating this? They're about to have this hit them slam up in the face, because also in 2018, a significant study was published on clinicaltrials.gov by the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense in 2018 was awarded $1.3 million to study a specific cannabinoid to reduce irritability and improve socialization in children with autism. Can you explain to me why the Department of Defense is interested in using cannabinoids to treat autism? Do they have this issue with pediatric populations in the military? I can't figure out that link. But this study is actually finished its clinical phase two trial, meaning that they've already completed the study. It ended last August of 2023, and we expect a publication date in July 2024. So that's coming up. But the big question is, why does the Department of Defense have an interest in studying autism spectrum disorders in children? Not only is research bearing out how there are differences in the endocannabinoid system and the cannabinoids within the body affect the disruptions in the autism spectrum disorder population, we're also starting to tease out which cannabinoids from the plant seem to have the most beneficial effects. What we always have to weigh here are the harm reduction approaches. We want to have zero harms when we begin to integrate a treatment plan for our patients. And we've already seen how the treatment plan for autism affects those individuals. Not so much on the behavioral programs, meaning that, you know, we're not harming them by helping them with their behavior. What we're seeing associated with harms are all of the pharmaceuticals that we begin to give these individuals at a very young age. And so from a harm reduction perspective, it seems that the cannabinoids are much safer with less risks and more benefits. The question is, what dosages do we use and what cannabinoids do we use? Because we are talking about a very vulnerable and young population. We don't want to do any more harm. CBD has been the forerunner. Why? Because CBD is, first of all, non-psycho-impairing, non-toxic, no withdrawals, no tolerance. There are many benefits to using the cannabinoid that has no adverse effects except when used in high doses. We know that CBD can be used safely up to 6,000 milligrams a day. How do we know this? Because CBD has one FDA-approved drug, Epidiolex. Epidiolex is administered to children over 1 year of age that have uncontrollable seizure conditions. And so now these children who are using Epidiolex are growing into middle and young adulthood, meaning that they would have died earlier if they hadn't had Epidiolex, which is made out of pure CBD. So that is where we're getting our parameter that 6,000 milligrams is pretty much the maximum dose that we would want to give to somebody. And even that doesn't have adverse effects. It has very benign side effects such as nausea, vomiting, somnolence, which is meaning you just feel tired and fatigued. Sometimes you have some GI disruption, like some diarrhea, but there have been no overdoses regarding CBD. As researchers look at the CBD's mechanism of action in relation to autism, we find that it modulates the glutamate GABA systems, meaning that it promotes more of a calming balance, that inhibitory balance versus the excitation balance. As it regulates this glutamate and GABA transmission, the imbalances that occur in autism will then begin to resolve as CBD not only repairs the damage, but it prevents further imbalances of this glutamate GABA exchange. When you have a balance between the excitatory and the inhibitory neurotransmitters, we can now begin to calm that overexcitability in the nervous systems, while also addressing many of the other conditions like anxiety, sleep, depression, GI conditions that could be associated with that excitation. We talked about how our body's own endocannabinoid, known as anandamide, promotes oxytocin secretion. CBD has been shown to enhance oxytocin release, which now can help to improve social interactions in autism. So we have two mechanisms where CBD can improve both a behavioral social interaction as well as an overexcited nervous system that could promote seizure disorders. CBD works in a specific receptor known as the 5-HT1A receptor, And it actually helps to facilitate the anti-anxiety effects as the 5-HT1A receptor secretes serotonin. Serotonin is our mood balancer. And CBD works in the dopamine receptors, which is where most of our antipsychotics work in the treatment of pharmaceutical autism. When we talk about CBD, we want to talk about a starting dose of approximately 1 milligram per kilogram per day in a child. Children are dosed by their weight, so it would take a very long, steady increase, a titration over 2 to 3 weeks to a target goal of 5 to 10 milligrams of CBD per kilogram per day. And this could be divided into 2 to 3 daily doses. We're still under the 10 milligrams per day maximum dosage per kilogram. And more than likely, even if the child develops, you know, growth, we still can meet that 6,000 milligram or less, knowing that that's our threshold.
Cannabis Nurse Truths is brought to you by Hemp Haven Wellness. Let's face it, hemp is complex, coming in several different forms. You probably have many questions about the differences between cannabis and hemp, and why hemp can be used in numerous ways to treat well-being. At Hemp Haven, they have the knowledge and expertise to guide your selection of hemp-derived products to meet your wellness needs. Hemp Haven is owned and operated by America's cannabis nurse, Dr. Denise Foster. With Hemp Haven, fight insomnia, relieve headaches, relieve pain, improve your mood, promote relaxation, and more. Visit Hemp Haven in Chesapeake at 480 Kempsville Road, or visit them online at hemphavenwellness.com. That's hemphavenwellness.com. For the highest quality and safest products on the market, you want Hemp Haven Wellness.
Surprisingly enough, CBD is not the cannabinoid under study by the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is researching a cannabinoid known as CBDV. I feel like, I can't remember his name. He played the wizard in Harry Potter.
Alan Rickman.
CBDV.
CBDV.
Okay. CBDV. CBDV stands for cannabidivarin. The V on the N is a different cannabinoid than CBD, and it is just one of the hundreds of compounds that we're discovering in the cannabis plant. This cannabinoid acts on different neurological targets in the brain. It actually develops a synergism of all of these neurological receptors to modulate the glutamate and GABA release of those hormones. It works in the areas of the brain that are known to affect the prefrontal cortex and the basal ganglia. The basal ganglia contain a lot of receptors that CBDV may bind to and activate, which then would create less glutamate in the system. This makes it evident that if there's less glutamate being released from the basal ganglia, there are less excitatory stimulations going on, meaning that now we're reducing those pyramidal symptoms like tremors or drooling or even seizures. Additionally, CBDV, when it binds to these other receptors, it rapidly desensitizes them, making it a key to controlling the excitation release of neurotransmitters that allow the brain to decide how to either react, to think, or to promote a stimulating nerve sensitization down the road, down the line. The research surrounding CBDV is not only being conducted by the Department of Defense, but we're finding many individuals who are using CBDV are doing it with a very effective response to autism spectrum symptoms. Early CBDV treatment might partially prevent or lessen the development of symptoms. And not only that, we find that CBDV will help all of the neurotransmitters return to normal in cases of autism. There was a study that showed that in autistic individuals that had the lowest baseline glutamate measures, when they were given CBDV, the individuals had the best response in relation to resolving their symptoms of autism, whereas individuals who had the highest levels of glutamate in their body experienced a decrease in glutamate levels. This means that this is a negative correlation. The negative correlation is dose dependent, and it also depends on the disorder. This is a way of saying that if you have severe autism spectrum disorder symptoms, if you're high up on the spectrum, you will be more than likely benefited much greater by a CBDV administration, as it reduces the glutamate and brings your brain back into balance. Those individuals who are on the lower spectrum of this disorder, they don't seem to have as much improvement because, again, they didn't have as much symptomology in that disorder, meaning that, yes, we can still bring their brain back into a balance in response to glutamate levels, but it's not as significant as when those who have the most severe glutamate disorders are now balanced. When I read this report coming across from the Department of Defense, it made me say, what? The Department of Defense is looking at CBDV? Where can I find this magical unicorn, this mythical creature? Several years ago, I found one company that created CBDV, and this is an isolated cannabinoid that the American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't want you to know about. CBDV is not impairing. It is not causing any changes in the body except for what we know it does in the brain, according to research. I started stocking CBDV in my shop, and I spoke about it on a radio program I was on. I had parents coming into me who listened to that radio program saying, I want to try some of this. And so one in particular brings to mind was a mom who had two little girls in tow with her, and both of them had autism. They're on the autism spectrum disorder. We talked at length. She asked the right questions, and she said, I wanted to check with my pediatrician. Absolutely. Go check with your pediatrician and let's discuss this. The pediatrician gave her the okay. We began to work with her and dose her children using CBDV as an isolated cannabinoid. Within 3 days, the mother came back to me and cried in my shop saying that you have changed my children's lives forever. They were nonverbal. That's where they were on the ASD spectrum. They were now calling her mommy. This mom has now had her children on small dosages, small drops of CBDV for the last 2 years, and she brings them into the shop quite regularly. You cannot tell these children apart from anyone. Their teachers report that they get good grades, they pay attention, their socialization skills and their developmental skills are appropriate for their age, and the mom has made me promise never to stop stocking CBDV in my shop. Now I have several sources because those vendors are following the research as well, and we're finding that CBDV in the autism spectrum disorder has much potential for benefits. Benefits versus risks. Using cannabinoids that are not THC like CBD and CBDV will reduce the frequency and intensity of the hyperactivity. They will affect the sleep problems, the anxiety, the restlessness, the pacing and tapping. These are known as the extra pyramidal symptoms that we try to control with antipsychotics. Irritability and aggressiveness. These are typically associated again with the antipsychotics, and the cannabinoids do none of this. That helps with social communication and rage attacks. We can support a reduced need for medications as the CBD or the CBDV now help to repair and prevent further breakdown in these systems. And we also found that in some studies, there was a reduced need for one-to-one support for activities, meaning that these children who were treated with either CBD or CBDV were now able to go to school without their one-to-one support, and it improved their focus and attention. And this is what I was seeing from my mom, who comes to see me in the shop and continues to dose her two daughters with CBDV. Where we're going with all of this is, first of all, we absolutely need more randomized controlled trials. The Department of Defense will hopefully report in July that they found both positive and maybe negative outcomes that will again be forming an iterative process where we don't settle the science on cannabinoids and autism. we explore it further and we want to identify the risks and the harms in more studies. But we're talking about a very vulnerable population. We have to be very careful about who we give cannabinoids to in relation to the fact that we know that they will affect development in important areas like the brain. We also know that we can begin using the circulating endocannabinoids to help identify somebody who may have autism. This is another issue in autism. We can't pinpoint the etiology, how it starts, and we also have to combine a lot of different symptoms to make a formal diagnosis. It's a very latent disease. It's a very latent disorder. And if we can develop a test where we can evaluate the number of anandamide molecules, we now have a possible biomarker for diagnosing autism. We can then begin treating earlier with either the CBD or the CBDV products because we know that they will be safe and non-toxic and non-impairing, and they seem to have a much better harm-to-benefit ratio than current standards of pharmaceuticals. CBD can be integrated safely into any treatment plan, and CBD has significantly been shown to alter the functioning connectivity in the brain regions associated with autism, meaning that even at the most minimum, parents should begin having a discussion with their pediatrics professionals, like the neurologists, to decide whether or not additionally adding CBD to their child's treatment plan could be beneficial. We need more education to our medical schools and our nursing schools. The other question we have about these changes in autism is, can we extend them to other childhood populations like those with Down syndrome? Sometimes the same issues related to the neurological imbalances and neuroinflammatory imbalances will be affecting those children that have Down syndrome. So could we maybe make that leap to where it's effective in one childhood disorder like autism? Can we maybe begin affecting other childhood disorders starting with Down syndrome? Overall advantages to incorporating cannabinoids into a treatment plan show that children have decreased prescription use, better REM sleep. There's a high compliance because these compounds are easy to dose and easy to take. There are low adverse effects risks, and there's no intoxication or withdrawal symptoms. There's no tolerance. They've improved symptoms, but more than anything, when you incorporate cannabinoids into a treatment plan in populations with children with autism, you have overall improved quality of life, not for just the child, but for the whole family as a unit. And we need to have more conversations about cannabinoids in the treatment of autism. I do want to make people aware that there is a resource for parents who are interested in using a holistic approach, and it's called Whole Plant Access for Autism, and you can find them at WPA4A.org. And this is an organization that educates and shows families how to choose and or make safe medicine regarding cannabis as a treatment option for autism. So this would be someplace where, you know, cannabis-friendly populations and families could meet and help each other as a support resource for those individuals who are interested in using cannabis in the treatment of autism.
Thank you for listening to episode number 12 of Cannabis Nurse Truths. Join us once again next week. Every Wednesday, we have a new episode wherever you get your podcasts. Visit the website CannabisNurseTruths.com. And don't forget to follow us at Canna Podcast on X, formerly known as Twitter, C-A-N-N-A Podcast. She's Dr. Denise Foster. I'm Lee Foster. Thanks again.